Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, stream our show at nprnews.org/listen live every weekday at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the show.
Good morning. This is NPR News. I'm Chris Farrell, in for Carrie Miller. A letter by leading public health experts recently published in the venerable medical journal The Lancet called for global efforts to challenge loneliness. Researchers have found that loneliness in the workplace takes a toll on mental and physical health. Studies of older Americans suggest loneliness can lead to shorter lives, cognitive decline, physical deterioration, and depression. Loneliness can happen throughout life, at any time. That said, one concern with the aging of the population is that loneliness and social isolation will become an even bigger problem than it is today. Some governments are responding to the public health threat. Most notably, when Theresa May was Britain's prime minister, she made combating loneliness a policy priority. She appointed a minister for loneliness, a new cabinet position. Yet there has long been prejudice associated with talking about loneliness, let alone admitting that you're lonely or you feel socially isolated. So to better understand why loneliness has become a major public health concern, I'm joined by two experts. Dr. Preethi Mulani is director of the National Poll on Healthy Aging and a geriatrician at the University of Michigan. She joins us by phone. Glad you could join us.
Thank you for having me.
Julian Holt-Lundstedt is a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Brigham Young University who studies social isolation. Welcome.
Thank you.
And we also want to hear from you. I mean, do you feel alone, socially isolated from your family, your peers, your community? What do you think is going on? Are you aware of an aging parent or a young person who is dealing with loneliness? We want to hear from you. Call us at 651-227-6000, toll-free 800-242-2828. And I want to start off with talking to each of you about your research because, you know, one of the pleasures of this job is you get to read about your research, and it was really fascinating. So to start with you, Julianne, you found that the mortality impact of loneliness is equivalent to smoking 15 cigarettes a day. And that's just a really striking figure. So how did that result emerge from your research?
Well, so I think most people recognize that our relationships or lacking relationships can impact our emotional well-being. But very few people recognize the profound effects that it can have on our health. And so to really make sure that we had the strongest possible evidence to establish that, we looked across all of the epidemiological data in order to get an estimate of the strength of how much that affects our risk for premature mortality. And when we were able to find that magnitude, we also recognized that we needed to benchmark that relative to other kinds of factors that we take quite seriously. And so in doing so, we recognize that it indeed was comparable and in many cases exceeded things that we take quite seriously for our health.
And were you surprised by the results?
So not really, in the sense that we have had evidence for decades now that aspects of relationships, so whether it's social isolation or being more socially integrated, that these do predict our longevity or lifespan. But it was really more that the wider public and the medical community didn't recognize this. And I think that's what led to the meta-analysis. But one of the things that was a bit surprising was that both the subjective and objective indicators, whether you're objectively alone or subjectively feeling alone, both significantly predict risk for premature mortality.
Okay. And Preethi, the University of Michigan National Poll on Healthy Aging, and this is from 2018, I believe, asks, as I understand it, a national sample of adults ages 50 to 80 about their health and experiences related to companionship and social isolation. And what did you find?
Yeah, so thank you. Yes, the National Poll on Healthy Aging, the report came out in March of 2019, but the survey was done at the end of 2018. And as you mentioned, Chris, this is a national survey. It was more than 2,000 older adults, and the age range was 50 to 80. So not just aging, but sort of the pre-aging.
Yeah.
And we asked just a couple of very basic questions regarding how often in the past year you have felt a lack of companionship. And also, how often have you felt isolated? And the percentages varied a little bit by groups, but overall, it was about 34% felt a lack of companionship at times, and about 27% felt isolated. And the portions were higher among certain groups, those who were unemployed, those living in lower-income households, those that were living alone, with including those with one or more children in the homes. And the data for younger adults, women were more likely to feel a lack of companionship compared to men. And we also noted an association with the physical and mental health piece. And not surprisingly, those who were lonely reported their self-reported health was worse both for physical health and mental health.
And so just for clarification, loneliness and social isolation, are they the same thing? Are they two sides of the same coin? Are they related but not the same thing?
Thank you for asking that question. So loneliness and social isolation, they tend to get lumped together. And while they are closely related, they are very distinct entities. And there are people who are socially isolated who could live alone and not see other people, but they're not lonely. And on the flip side, there can be people who are surrounded by many individuals, but they feel lonely. And thinking about it, really, like the basic definition, loneliness is sort of that subjective feeling of being alone or separated. It is a negative feeling in contrast to, let's say, solitude, which could be the need to be by yourself or, you know, feeling separated, but not as a bad thing. On the flip side, social isolation is a physical phenomena where you are separated from other people. Sometimes it's because you're living alone, but it could also be because maybe you don't hear very well or you don't see very well. Mm. And so you could, again, be around people. And I think the hearing loss is a good example where you might be physically near people, but you're isolated.
And Julianne, so, I mean, everybody feels lonely at some time. I mean, we all go through periods where we feel lonely. So what we're discussing is something more sustained, systemic, longer term.
Right. And in fact, many neuroscientists have argued that humans are, in essence, social beings, and that being social is a fundamental human need. And have argued that loneliness is much like hunger or thirst. It's a biological drive. So much like hunger is a biological drive that motivates us to seek out food, that loneliness is a biological drive that motivates us to reconnect. And so in that sense, it is adaptive in the short term. And what becomes problematic is when we experience loneliness more on a chronic basis.
So let's go to the phones, and let's go to Will in Minneapolis. Will?
Hi.
Hi. So what's your comment?
First of all, just excited about the topic. Thanks for having me. I'm a student in landscape architecture at the University of Minnesota, and focusing on sort of the built environment and it's kind of the role that it plays in social isolation and loneliness, especially with older adults, and just looking at how the care system has kind of become this segmented and isolated kind of set of parts that kind of breeds isolation itself. I'm thinking about like what care is and how we can make caring the easy choice sort of in our built environments and how we can start to establish these more meaningful interactions between people, whether it's activating bus stops or something like that, and just getting kind of people to go outside and giving them access to quality spaces where sort of social support can exist outside.
And I'm curious, is this something that a lot of the other students are also talking about, or are you sort of, you know, the lone person that's interested in this particularly age-friendly topic?
I think that there are a lot of people that are interested in kind of loneliness as it pertains to younger kids, because millennials, I think in a lot of the surveys are one of the loneliest populations, but I'm kind of the one that's interested in the older adults.
Okay. So Preeti.
Yes.
Your reaction to, you know, about thinking about the urban environment, the design of our cities, whether that's for younger people or older people. One of the things that always struck me was Alan Glucksman. He's a professor at Temple University. And one of the things that he said is what he's learned over his long career is what's good for older people is good for young people. And what's good for young people is good for older people. And so I think sometimes the divisions may not be as important as the overall environment.
I would agree with that comment. And I actually appreciated Will's comments regarding his work in landscape architecture. And there is quite a bit of interest in the general architecture fields, too, around built environments or just really being very intentional about design to try to bring people together. I have to say, sometimes, even though the best intentions are there, like, for example, in dining halls in college campuses, sometimes people still don't want to sit together. So you can build the environment. It might not necessarily work. But some of the issues that are unique to older adults may be some of the physical accessibility pieces, having spaces where you can have meaningful interaction. And, you know, we certainly think about parks and walkways and things like that, which are important. One of the things that I think about in the workplace, and again, most adults, even many older adults, they do work,
yeah,
is break rooms, which is something that you might not think about. And the fact that that's a place that there's a lot of really good positive interaction, and sometimes between people who may not see each other otherwise. So it can be at that high level and thinking about communities. Now, that may not benefit everybody, particularly those who don't live in a more urban or suburban environment. But thinking about just common spaces in general and having, whether it's in a mall and having a central area where people can sit and potentially interact. One of the grocery stores in Ann Arbor, you know, they had a little area where people would play games at night, you know, just board games, which I found kind of fascinating. There seemed to be like this group of individuals who would come together around grocery shopping. So I think it can be things that are pretty simple and low tech.
Yeah. And Julianne, any additional comments to Will's observation about this sort of urban environment or thinking about the architecture of the environment?
Yeah, I think it's a wonderful point that Will brought up because the built environment can have such a profound effect on our the way in which we live and our behaviors. And our surroundings can absolutely influence how we engage with our environment, from whether or not our city is walkable, or our community, I should say, is walkable or is safe, can have a profound effect on the extent to which people get out and engage in their community. We also see striking shifts in our demographics. And so we need to also think about how we design housing and integrating this with workspace. And I know that recently there was a design challenge in Denmark aimed specifically at not just designing beautiful buildings, but designing buildings to foster social connections, to really design for the people who inhabit these buildings. And I think it can have a profound effect, absolutely.
Well, let's go to Arlo in Northfield. Arlo?
There.
And your question or observation?
Oh, yeah. Hey. Oh, yeah, sure. Well, I have had, I've got a lot of friends, young men that kind of feel isolated in their lives. Or like, I guess my observation is just like the impact. I wonder about the impact of isolation and loneliness on like men's lives in particular. I was really interested by the comment that women feel in the studies more isolated or lonely than men. But I was just curious if you wanted to say more about that.
Sure. And so these are you're like 25. These are your peers?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I noticed that I've got a lot of friends that are older. I'm a farmer down here, and I see that. I think, you know, it's kind of being a part of a rural community, it looks a lot different than being
sure
in a kind of an urban space.
Preeti?
Yeah, no, I think I don't think that loneliness really is particular to any one group. And as we talked about, younger individuals are probably reporting even higher rates. And I think it's an interesting comment. I did say that with our data, we found that the rates were higher among women than men. And again, these are self-reported rates, but the rates are quite high in everyone, alarmingly high. And as to why, you know, people report it more, and is it just a feeling like that people, they can say that they feel isolated, and you know, maybe perhaps men are less likely to report it? Is it because of the workforce and going to work, or, you know, just different expectations? I don't actually understand the reasons, but I would say that it is not exceptionally different by gender.
Okay.
And I don't know if Julianne has other thoughts on that.
Julianne?
Yeah. So interestingly, there was a Cigna survey that just came out, I think, last week that showed that men were slightly more lonelier than women. And so this can vary across different surveys. And like Dr. Preeti Malani was saying, this can certainly affect both men and women. And what we find is that the health effects are equivalent across both men and women. So regardless, this can have a profound effect. But I do think his point is important, because it raises the question of the extent to which people feel comfortable reporting loneliness. And I think there's a lot of shame and stigma around this. And to some extent, that may be more difficult to admit among certain groups than other groups, but certainly difficult regardless. And so one of the things that I think we need to work on is reducing some of that stigma around this issue.
And I want to ask the same question to both of you, and then I'm going to go back to the phone lines. Is there a root cause to loneliness? I mean, what is the root cause that's going on here that is showing up in your research and your reporting and these surveys that's saying, you know, that loneliness is a problem? Can we point to a root cause?
I can jump in, and particularly sure. From the standpoint of older adults, which is more my area of focus, there is not one root cause. It can be different for different folks. It can be physical limitations. It can be just mobility, getting in and out. It can be issues around memory loss and difficulty engaging with individuals. It can be lack of transportation, which is a very practical barrier. People may not be able to drive on their own, or may not have access to reliable transportation. It can be other factors. It can be physical distance. And, you know, I think and again, loneliness doesn't mean necessarily that you are isolated, but with a lot of older adults, I think that link is more clear. And there is not one particular cause.
Julianne?
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. And just to expand, some of the factors that have been identified as risk factors for loneliness or social isolation, some can overlap. And so, for instance, both physical and mental health impairments can increase one's risk for becoming lonely. Also, if one is experiencing some kind of transition in life that may disrupt one's social network, so whether that is among young people, leaving home for the first time, starting at university, or transitioning into parenthood or retirement, that some of these transition periods may be potential points of risk. But there's really no one cause, and I think that's critically important to also recognize as we think about the complexity in trying to reduce risk as well.
So let's go to the phones to Pete, and Pete in Minneapolis.
Hi, I have a father who's in his mid-80s, I suppose, and okay. He snowbirds a lot. You know, he's in Minnesota for the summers and Florida in the winters.
Okay.
And it's just, I've noticed the older he gets, the harder it is for him to sort of engage with folks, and he really doesn't have anybody. And it's just, I wonder what you do with, particularly, I think, with men, you were saying before, harder to engage with other people. I wonder how we, you know, get people like that out of them, out of their shell and things like that. I'll go off the air.
Oh, thank you for that. And briefly, any thoughts?
Sure. Yeah. This is not an uncommon issue. And I think if we think about diet or exercise or any other issues that we're trying to make a difference in, I think it depends on the person. And I feel like it's helpful to even bring it up in the healthcare setting so that in this case, his father's care, you know, whoever's taking care of him, physicians and others, are even aware that this is a concern. You know, if it's a physical limitation, just getting in and out of the house, I think sometimes bringing resources into the house, whether that's actually bringing people into the home, and then there is a role for technology. I don't think that replaces one-on-one interaction, but it can be something that can at least mitigate some of the issues. One of the big things is that each individual's needs and their resources are different.
Sure.
But I do recognize, and it's an interesting issue, that with age, sometimes people also, and it sounds sort of interesting, but people almost don't want to engage with new people because it's like, well, what's the point? This person's going to go on and, like, they're not going to be in my life. And I've heard about this phenomena even in senior communities where there's this, it's almost a maladaptive thinking about it where you almost don't want to get close to people. And I think that's understandable, but maybe unfortunate. So I think, again, thinking about your father's different interests and are there some places. And one of the things we haven't talked about is the intergenerational component. And we've touched on the issue of loneliness in younger people. And there are sometimes systems in place and volunteer programs where younger adults can engage with older adults, and it is a really wonderful thing, a wonderful relationship that can develop if the people are interested in this. And it might be helping someone grocery shop. It might be just coming by to visit. It might be helping around the house. But we think about that the epidemic of loneliness in younger people, too. And sometimes having a relationship, having a friendship with someone who is not your parents or your grandparents even, but just someone who is older and wiser, perhaps, can be a good thing for both individuals.
Absolutely. So, well, before we go back to the phones, let's take a break. Our topic for right now is loneliness and social isolation. And my guests are Dr. Preethi Malani, director of the National Poll on Healthy Aging and a geriatrician. Julian Holt-Lundstedt is a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Brigham Young University, and she studies social isolation. And let me give out the number again. Give us a call, 651-227-6000, toll-free, 800-242-2828. And before I go right back to the phones, Julian, I wanted to ask you, I think it was 2 decades ago, actually, now, or about 2 decades ago, there's a book by a sociologist, Robert Putnam, called Bowling Alone. And it was about the decline of a lot of the, you know, sort of activities and social institutions that would bring people together. And so what is there a relationship between what we're talking about in terms of loneliness and social isolation and what he was writing about these social institutions? And he used the bowling alley was kind of one of them that he was talking about. It could be the Kiwanis Club and some other clubs in a community, and the sort of decline in activity in these traditional social institutions.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up, because I think these are all very interrelated, and the way in which I have been examining this issue is really quite broad, in the sense that I look at how our social connections or lack thereof can impact health. And so, as you mentioned, this social capital and social engagement is part of that. And so really looking quite broadly at the variety of ways in which our relationships can impact our health, from the type of, you know, whether we are a member of some kind of social group, the size of our social network, to the functions that our relationships serve, you know, whether we have people we can rely on in times of need, to the quality of these relationships. Because, of course, we know that not all relationships are entirely positive. And so what the evidence suggests is that all of these can inform health. And one of the things that we're also seeing is some trends in declines in some of these kinds of markers. So, as you mentioned, the bowling alone, Putnam's book, there's some evidence to suggest that our social networks are shrinking, and that fewer people are participating in social groups like, you know, whether it's a sports club or a neighborhood club or, you know, the Kiwanis Club or a church group, that we see declines in this over time. And these are just a few. But what this suggests is that this issue has some degree of importance and perhaps even urgency.
Yeah. And let's go to the phones with Beth in St. Paul. Beth?
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call, and the timing of this is perfect. I have the privilege of working with the St. Paul Public Libraries, and I just want to really give a shout out to the role of the public library in addressing the social isolation that you're discussing. In particular, the work of Eric Kleinenberg in addressing social infrastructure and how institutions like libraries that are so free of barriers. I mean, they're free, they're open to the public, they're neighborhood-based, and so typically very convenient for folks, 7 days a week often, offering increasing numbers of programs and services targeted at both young people and older adults, to really in recognition of the role that we have to embrace as public libraries to address this increasing isolation and to help kind of reclaim the role of the library as social infrastructure. And I think particularly for older adults who may have a nostalgic notion of the library as a place that you go to seek solitude and check out a book for the very solitary experience of reading, I think there's some joy and delight to be found in today's contemporary public library, where programs and services bring people together in environments that are almost unrecognizable compared to libraries of generations past.
Yeah,
and can be a resource.
Yeah, that's right. I was watching a movie from the 1950s, and someone walked into a library and they were talking and they were told to be quiet right away.
Yeah, and you don't get shushed anymore.
And they don't, it does not happen anymore. So, Preethi, you know, one of the things in this whole area, and I love this example, the library, and libraries are vibrant and they are these community institutions, you know.
you analyze and you have this research about loneliness and social isolation. You know, what do you do about it? And so I think what Beth is talking about, you know, and what Julianne was talking about, getting to that idea about, okay, so how do we address this?
Yeah, thank you. And I love the comment about the library. And one of the things are the Ann Arbor Public Library, they have like an outreach, like a bookmobile that will come to you if you can't get there. So thank you, Beth, for the library reminder. So Chris, getting back to your question, like sort of what do you do about this? And I really think it's not a simple problem with like one answer, and each person might need a different approach. But I think the biggest issue is just, first of all, like raising awareness. And I think this is for family members, for older adults, for healthcare professionals, and for communities also to really think about this as a health issue. And we touched on this earlier, that there is sort of the direct health effects, and then there's sort of this less direct health effects, but particularly social isolation, it has enormous health consequences, and people who have chronic illnesses, chronic issues, they get worse, and not just depression and anxiety, but actually thinking of this as something that could lead even to premature death. There have been estimates that among Medicare beneficiaries alone, social isolation because of just issues with connecting with the healthcare system, that there's more than $6 billion in additional healthcare costs. So I think we need to prioritize this and really think of this as an opportunity. In terms of thinking about this, one is just screening for loneliness and social isolation. I think asking about it in the healthcare setting, and that's the kind of hat I wear as a physician, just making a point to ask, and then, you know, potentially making a suggestion yourself or referring individuals to someone who could be helpful. And I think letting family members also know that, you know, hey, your mother or father's or whoever it is in your life, the lack of connections, it could be a health issue because I don't think everyone thinks about it. And then there are community-based approaches, and you mentioned at the top of the hour some of the work in the United Kingdom, in England, and they've actually really embraced this, and they've even this campaign to end loneliness and the Minister of Loneliness. But I do think it doesn't just take individuals and healthcare settings and communities, but really at a policy level, embracing this issue as an important aspect of community health for our nation.
So, Julianne, do you think we should have I guess we wouldn't call it Minister of Loneliness. We'd call it Cabinet Member of Loneliness.
Yeah, or the Secretary.
Secretary
of Loneliness,
right? That's it, yes.
yeah. yeah, so, of course, you know, many people have asked me this question, and one of the things that I think was so remarkable about the appointment of the Minister for Loneliness is that it elevated the issue to something that gave it national prominence, that it was someone's responsibility to address this issue. And so, you know, I think we could certainly debate whether it should be just one person or whether, for instance, there should be this should be something that is across sectors. For instance, if we were to think about policy, the World Health Organization has this framework of health in all policy, and we could certainly think about social in all policy and think about how existing policies may either detract from or hinder social connection, or whether we can make modifications to these to facilitate social connection, and whether additional kinds of policies can be implemented as well. And, you know, I would like to reiterate that this really does need to go beyond the individual. And, you know, I love the example of the library because it gets us thinking about different ways in which we can tackle this. And as was mentioned, we have evidence that there is a real lack of awareness around this issue. And so that's really important. And one of the things that the UK has done is when they talk about when screening was mentioned, they have now established in their National Office of Statistics a standardized measure to measure loneliness. And so if we can assess this in the medical setting, and in fact, our own Institute of Medicine evaluated, you know, when we go to the doctor and there are all those things that are asked of us and assessed in terms of, you know, our weight, our blood pressure, all of these,
right.
And ask about our diet, our exercise. Social relationships need to be included in that. And the Institute of Medicine, when they evaluated this evidence, found that social connection / isolation had equivalent evidence as exercise and some of these other factors, which and recommended that these be included. And so we really just need to start thinking about how we can start implementing this across a variety of levels and including policy.
So let's go to Josh in St. Louis Park. Josh?
Hello. Thanks for taking my call, and thanks for this awesome conversation. I've been sitting in my car just nodding my head in agreement with all of this.
That's great.
It's just fantastic. And I'm fortunate to work with an organization called LifeSpark, and we've been helping individuals age magnificently for the last 15 plus years. And, you know, what we found over those last 15 year, plus years at LifeSpark is, you know, we can do all the health related stuff. We can provide the skilled home care, the private pay home care, the assisted living stuff. And we do all that really, really well. But when we actually discover more about the people that we're serving, and we don't call them assessments. We call it, you know, we discover about them. You know, we learn that they don't wake up in the morning to take their medications. They don't wake up in the morning to do their therapy and their exercises. So we really try to discover, you know, who they are as a person. What is their purpose, their passion, their identity? You know, what makes them who they are? And social isolation and social connections and all of the stuff that you all have been talking about this morning is so much more important or has just as much of an impact or more than the health related stuff that unfortunately our sick care system that we live in and work within today just doesn't focus enough attention on. So, that's where you can identify the transportation gaps and why somebody can't get to church on Sunday morning or go play cards with their girlfriends like they've done for the last 30 years, or they don't want to walk outside with that walker because they're embarrassed or worried about what their neighbors and friends are going to say. So, our whole goal has been to really try to tackle all the health related stuff, but in addition, all the other stuff that makes up who people are. And, you know, when you talk about the assessments and the screening, I mean, we do the PROM, the promise for every one of our individuals, which gets at all of the other stuff, not just the blood pressure, the weight and all that stuff. It's the happiness level, loneliness and everything. So thank you for the topic.
Yeah, thank you for calling in.
Awesome.
And Preethi, one of the things off his Josh's comments that there's also been in the medical literature, sort of the public health literature, sociologists, an increase, or at least this is my observation, an increase in the study of purpose. And there's also an increased study of loneliness. And I'm curious, are these sort of studies to looking at sort of the same phenomenon?
You know, I love the mention of the word purpose. And I think we're talking about it a lot, even within the medical field, as people are talking about mental health concerns among nurses and physicians and others, and just the epidemic of concerns in that space, and we focus a lot on purpose. Like, what is it that? And I think Josh kind of touched on that too, like with his comments. Like, what is it that you care about? What are you passionate about? And you know, I think it's funny is we're not as intentional about articulating that issue of purpose, but even helping individuals think about what is it that I'm interested in and that I want to get more involved in. And what we do find as a very general statement is those who have purpose or feel purpose or can identify purpose, they do better, even if they are and socially isolated. I think that it is something. So helping individuals find purpose, and I think articulating that that idea of purpose. And actually educating all the folks that work around this, and I, you know, I say that myself. You know, I think in geriatrics we do think about the physical environment and, you know, who is around people. But in every healthcare encounter, whether it's with a pharmacist or whether it's with a nurse checking blood pressure or you know, at a routine physician's visit, thinking about these issues and revisiting them.
And Jillian, is there almost a cruel irony? I mean, you can't listen to the news without, you know, people talking about, you know, we live in the age of connections, about connections. You know, if you think about Facebook and all the technology that's connecting them, and business leaders, executives, they always talk about their teams, and, you know, they're forming teams. And yet we really have this phenomenon of loneliness and social isolation going on at the same time. And I wonder, are they related? Is it how is that playing out?
Yeah, I think that's a question we all want the answer to, right? because, of course, we have all of these incredible tools that have made life simpler, more efficient, have a number of advantages, and should be making us more socially connected, and yet we see an increasing rate of people who are feeling isolated, feeling lonely, feeling not connected to others. And the sad reality is that the technological developments are outpacing the science. And so we really are having a hard time pinning down, you know, exactly. And of course, also, you know, I'm commonly asked the question, is technology bad or good? As if it's one thing, right?
Yeah, exactly.
there are so many devices, applications, environments, and then the way in which we use them can vary so dramatically as well. And so this is incredibly complex. And one of the things that I think is also important to recognize is that while we do have increasing evidence around this, most of the studies are correlational, meaning they just say, for instance, measure loneliness and social media use, right? And if you find a positive correlation between those, we can't really say that the social media use is leading to the loneliness, or whether people who are more lonely are more likely to use social media.
Right.
What we really need is more long-term kinds of studies. And when you think back to my meta-analysis, which established this as a risk factor for premature mortality, these studies followed people over years, often decades. And so if we think about the widespread use of smartphones, for instance, that wasn't until 2012 that over half of Americans had a smartphone. So that's relatively recent. So many of these studies began prior to the widespread use of this.
Right.
And so we really don't know the long-term health effects of the use of many of these. And so we really need to understand, because, frankly, I don't think anything's going away.
No, it's not going to disappear.
What we need to understand is the, you know, what aspects may be detrimental, and then what aspects may be beneficial. And so then we can harness the effects of the potential positive effects towards solutions, and minimize and try and go away from some of the effects that may be more detrimental.
Let's go to Sarah in Eagan. Sarah?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This is a really interesting topic to me. And at age 67, I'm retired and fortunately have still a spouse and children, grandchildren, lots of social groups that I'm part of, and organizations that I volunteer with. So for me, in friends that have lost their spouses or divorce, through divorce or death, and relatives, I see two different kinds of loneliness. One comes from just not getting out and being social enough and having friends and activities that you're involved in. And the other is the loss of a significant other. And so even some of those who are very active and get out and do things are still lonely because they don't have that significant other relationship in their life.
Yeah.
And that's just an observation. And then another observation is that in some type cases, I see it being related to addiction and mental health, depression and whatnot, that, you know, people, there is so much. Living and hearing about the library, and I know the Silver Sneakers, you can join clubs. I'm still active at the Y.
Right, at the Y.
Free of cost and free of charge for somebody on Medicare. I have lots of friends who go to our community center and are active. And then I know people who could get out and do all those things but just choose not to, stay home, and then are sad and complaining because they're lonely.
Right. So, yeah, you raised a lot of issues, but and Preeti, you pick up whatever you would like, but that the, you know, there are these options, but you got to get to them.
Yeah. No, Sarah, thank you for the comment. And I agree, you know, that it's really grief in some ways. And it's grief with change and it's, you know, with losing loved ones. And, you know, going to a book club, it doesn't take care of that, doesn't like make that go away. But it is, I think it's a process of adjustment that whether people adjust and they continue to thrive with their new reality or they don't ever adjust and then they see their own decline in health. And, you know, those are observations that are from forever ago, that the risk of an individual's death in the year following the loss of a spouse or a child is very high. It's heightened for individual, their own health decline and even death. But I think it sort of gets at that social network that we talked about. Like when you have high quality connections, I think that everything else becomes a little bit easier.
Right. They rally around you. And,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. And there's not a simple way to get at it. But I think, again, raising awareness and I think just going back and making sure that if it's a barrier of transportation or if it's a barrier of people just don't know what resources are out there, at least that part is relatively simple. The harder part is actually making it happen for someone who just maybe isn't ready or not interested.
So we only have 1 minute left. Julianne, very quickly, what would you like to leave people with when they're thinking about loneliness?
Yeah, I think what I would hope that people will start to recognize is that we now have robust evidence of the health effects around social connection and conversely social isolation and loneliness. And that these rival the things that we take seriously for our health, and we need to start taking our relationships just as seriously for our health.
And Preeti?
Yeah, I would say something similar in that the social connectedness piece is just as important as checking someone's weight and blood pressure when they enter the healthcare setting.
Well, thank you very much. This has been a wonderful conversation, and our guests have been Dr. Preeti Mulani. She's director of the National Poll on Healthy Aging, and she is a geriatrician, and Julian Holt-Lunstad, professor of psychology and neuroscience at Brigham Young University, and she studies social isolation. And thank you for all the calls.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. If you'd like to hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks for listening.